Since we are moving towards the time, moving towards Sukkot, the festival of moving out of the house and living in a sukkah, so that is a perfect opportunity to discuss the deeper issue which underlies the idea of the sukkah, which is the issue of faith, emunah, the issue of faith. The deep sources, the Kabbalistic sources, refer to the sukkah as tzele de mehemnusa, which means the shadow of faith. When you move out into the area, the zone of the sukkah, so you're moving from something solid into the zone of faith, which really should be even more solid. But it doesn't look that way. Let's just spend a moment trying to understand why the question of emunah, faith, which is the central issue in all of spiritual thinking and work, really, why that's connected to the sukkah. Let's try and get that clear. Maybe next week we'll have a chance to work it through further. But let's at least try and establish that. And then we'll try to look more deeply at the subject of emunah itself and see if we can, with your permission, see if we can work it out. First of all, the sukkah is the idea of moving into a place that is flimsy, where you can see the stars and where the rain can come through. The idea of that is to move out of a place that gives you the illusion of security and protection into a place that does not appear to give you any degree of protection from the elements or security at all. The message is, the obvious message is, that your protection, if you have any, if you deserve any, and if you have any, does not come from the concrete walls and the high-tech security systems that you have in place. It comes from a different place entirely. You can live in a sukkah and be protected and be fine. You can live in a concrete castle and experience disaster. But the problem is that that message is not an easy one to assimilate. When you live cushioned by wealth and tangible security, you feel different than when you live in a flimsy structure where I have a friend in Johannesburg who lives in an upmarket part of town, where the homes are palatial, and in proportion to the solidity of the homes is the security fear. So he lives in a house with an electrified fence and an 8-foot wall and a security firm that, you know, patrols outside and guards the house. A couple of years ago, when it came to Sukkot time, he wanted to live in a sukkah. Now, you're exempt from a sukkah if there's obvious danger or some other issue, but he wanted to fulfill the mitzvah. So he hired the security firm. He hired the security guard to stand outside the sukkah. Right? So he moved out of his mansion and slept in the sukkah, as one should. But to make it safe, he had a guard stand out the sukkah. The guard called his friends. The guard, security guard, non-Jewish security, called his friends to see this Jew, to see what he was being employed to do. He was being employed to stand outside a hut with some leaves on the roof to guard this Jew, right, being paid to guard this Jew who lives in a high-tech, you know, fortress, right, who wants to sleep in the garden in a so the guard, no doubt, and his friends failed to understand. But that's exactly the idea. That's exactly the idea. The time of Sukkot is really the time of the harvest. And the message is that when you feel most cushioned by your own, when you plant seeds and nothing's grown, you feel vulnerable. But when the harvest is reaped and your storehouse is full, your investments have come home, then you tend to get a little self-confident and you tend to feel the thickness of your wallet is the thickness of the wall between you and Hashem, basically. When your wallet thins, then you approach more closely. When it goes into overdrive, you know, overdrive, then you feel closer. Right? So you are, at this time of year, when the harvest is brought home. You bring it all home. And you may feel secure and have all your needs met. And that's a time when we move out into the sukkah to say, to teach ourselves, that's not necessarily so. We read Koheles, which is that the whole of the physical world is all vanity and nothing. That's what we do on, that's what we work on sukkahs. We enjoy, amazing thing, the Jewish personality. We move out into the sukkah to teach ourselves, amazing, amazing thing. We move out there to teach ourselves that security and wealth and tangible protection is really nothing. And all that really counts is what he's got in mind for you. That's what we do. And yet, to go against the natural way of the world is that when you got wealth and you got protection, so then you feel secure. So we go against that, we move out in a flimsy environment to not feel secure. But what is our state of mind? This is the time of rejoicing. Samachta b'chagecha, the mitzvah is to rejoice. That's a strange thing. The Torah tells a Jew that the way you're supposed to rejoice is when you have all the security that you could rely on, you don't use that, you go out someplace else, put yourself into a flimsy environment, there's no obvious protection, and that is joy. I mean, the simple message, of course, is that you should be able to generate joy even when you're not confident of your natural protection. But of course, the real deep message is that is the time of joy. The only time, the only possibility for happiness is in this world, is if you know that this world itself, if you trust this world, and you think that it's a firm reality that is to be trusted, you're in very, very great danger. Because there are no guarantees that it won't let you down. And somebody is overconfident in the world, there are only two options. Either guaranteed to let you, either will let you down, or you're not worth being taught the message. If you have confidence in this world, and its physicality and its materialism, and you never get shaken up, it's a disastrous sign. The Gemara says if you have no trouble for 40 days, no suffering for 40 days, you're in disastrous trouble. No worries, nothing goes wrong for 40 days in a row, you're in big trouble. Because it means you're not worth being sensitized. That's like a father saying to his child, look, I've tried everything. I tried punishments, I've tried enticements, I wash my hands of you, whatever. That's the worst din you can have, the worst judgment you can have. And Rosh Hashanah is no judgment at all. You're a statistic. You want to believe in the physicality and the natural process of the world, it's up to you. Right? So the deep joy that we feel is when we know that the world is to be used and enjoyed. On the contrary, you have physical enjoyment. On the contrary, you have to eat and drink, you have to eat in the sukkah. You have to eat festive meals. For a man, it's supposed to be meat and wine. For a woman, husband's supposed to buy a new outfit. I don't know if you know about that. So it says, Jewish obligation, new outfit every Yom Tov. That's what it says. And children, you have to give them special sweets and things that children enjoy. And yet, the underlying simcha here is that there's something deeper going on. Amazing thing. Who would think of such a thing? Who would think of such a commandment, such a religious process, right, of leaving your house and going to live in a hut? Remarkable thing. There's a deeper level here, of course, and that is that the sukkah, the word sukkah in Hebrew is a remarkable word. The word sacha, which is the root here, means to see through. Remarkable thing. Yeah, to see through. You know, technically the sukkah has to be that you can see through. The sukkah is supposed to be the roof of the sukkah. We're not going to go now into all the laws. The roof of the sukkah, which is the main halachic feature of the sukkah, and the walls can be solid, but the roof has to be temporary. The roof has to be natural material that has not been worked or processed in any way. That is vegetation, yeah, vegetable material, leaves, whatever, branches, that is completely natural. That has to be, ideally, that you can see the stars through, but at least that the rain should be able to get through. Right? It can be thick, but the rain should be able to get through. And yet, it should be transparent. The word sacha, sukkah, is based on sacha. Sacha means, the classic example is that Sarah, right, the wife of Avraham Avinu, his wife, Sarah Imenu, one of the great mother of the Jewish people, the original forerunner, right, on the woman's side. One of her names was Yiska, which is the same root. Because I call Sachin Bayofya, everybody could see, well, it's hard to translate. In English, you'd say, could see in her beauty. But the real meaning is that everybody could see through her beauty. What it means is, a very deep message, you don't want to go into it fully now, but it means that she was an incredibly beautiful woman. In the conventional sense, it doesn't mean she was spiritually beautiful. She certainly was spiritually beautiful. But she was incredibly beautiful in the most natural womanly sense. The reason that we know that is because when she went down to Egypt, the Egyptians, who were contaminated with tremendous immorality, could hardly control themselves when they saw her. They insisted they would have killed her husband and they wanted to take her to their king. So she obviously was almost irresistibly attractive in the conventional sense. Right? And yet the Torah calls her Yiska. That means when you looked at her, you saw Hashem. That means, again, for a woman to look when a woman looks, this is what you call tznius. Tznius means, for a woman who is beautiful, to present herself with a kind of modesty and dignity and refinement, Jewish refinement and dignity, that when you see her, at, with all the potential for seeing her in the lower way, and you look at her and you see something angelic, that's called tznius. Tznius doesn't mean a woman who walks around wearing a sack and that's not tznius. Tznius means a woman who projects beauty, but with such a refinement that when you see her, you see something higher. That's tznius. When you looked at Sarah, you saw, if you're an Egyptian, you saw something that was almost irresistible in the animal sense. But if you had any eyes to see, you looked at this woman of that kind of beauty and you saw an angel. That's called being transparent. It means to see through the physicality and see the spirit inside. That's what a woman has to teach, of course. And of course, that's the problem with this generation. But that's another story. And therefore, the word sacha means to see through. When you move into a sukkah, the simple meaning is that you see through, you see the heaven, you see the stars through the schach. But the deep meaning is that this is an opportunity to see through physicality. And that's why the sukkah is such a high place, tremendously high place. You have to be very careful how you conduct yourself in the sukkah, very careful where you speak in there. Right? I mean, to the naked eye, it's a simple hut with branches on the roof. But to spiritual eyes, you see what that is. That's a place of intense spirituality. Some people are even afraid to sleep there, even though we follow the halacha that we do sleep in the sukkah. There are those who are too afraid to sleep there. I mean, it's a tremendous, unbelievable opportunity. So Sukkot is the time of building emunah. So let's talk this evening a little bit, let's begin the discussion at least, of the nature of, it's an exhausting subject to have to talk about because it lives in the real and beyond words. And yet we have only words to use to try to point the direction and to try and teach ourselves what the process of knowledge has to be here. But essentially the subject lives in a world that's a world of inner knowledge where the words are not adequate. But again, let's try and make that effort together. What we mean this evening in this discussion, what we want here is to reach beyond where the words are. If you stick at the level of the meaning of the words, then we'll be discussing anything other than emunah. Emunah is where the words take you into their own transcendence. That it takes you into the inner recess of the heart, where only a kind of silence is the appropriate tool. And it's paradoxical that you have to speak about something like that, but let's perhaps try and do that. To put it like this, you could say that what the words can do is bring you to the brink, to the edge of the cliff. That the words can do. Leaping off the edge into that other zone, that's something else. That's into the zone beyond words. Emunah lies there, doesn't lie on the edge of the cliff. With the security of the edge of the cliff on the solid ground beneath you, that's not emunah. It's necessary. You have to do that, and logic and words take you there. But emunah lies in the zone that another type of, a different type of solidity, a different type of focus, different type of mental energy and inner knowledge is required. But we do the words and we do the logic because it gets us to the brink. But the leap off, right, which is anything other than a blind leap, but it's a different process, right? That is something you cannot speak about. But let's see if we can bring ourselves at least to the brink, as it were, and see if we can use that as at least that little bit closer. We can get ourselves a little bit closer. Let's try and analyze it like this. We won't get through much, I'm afraid, of the discussion because obviously endless discussion that touches on all aspects of Torah and all aspects of of life. Emunah is the underlying, the first mitzvah in the Torah, is relating to Hashem, knowing that He exists, God, relating to Him, even though He's not tangible or visible. That's the first mitzvah that subsumes all others. Now obviously it reaches into every other facet and aspect of Torah and life. But let's do what we can at least to begin the process. Nothing more important than the subject. Right? Nothing more important. Perhaps we can do it like this. Just for convenience, let's start by phrasing a few questions. We could say this. The area of emunah, let's call it knowledge of something higher. Right? To put it bluntly, knowing that Hashem exists, that God exists, and the nature of that existence and what it means for us. something that's not tangible, something that's always given to doubt, even if you saw a miracle. Most people say, if only I could experience a miracle. If he spoke to me once, no problem, I'd be his. The truth is, if he spoke to you once, you'd probably run for therapy. That's what you'd probably do. And the next day, you'd wake up and tell yourself that you're probably dreaming, that you probably, you know, had too much of whatever it was you had, and, you know, you'd be a waste of a good miracle. But the kind of person who needs a miracle probably is not going to use it right. And the kind of person who doesn't need a miracle doesn't need it. The reason our generation has not experienced miracles is that we wouldn't use them right. Our tendency would be to try to take miracles and explain them in a natural way. Right? We even do that when incredible coincidences occur. We try to find... we're not sensitive, and so the tools that are used with us are only a different type of tools. But the question we can ask is like this. Is that focus of Emunah, that knowledge that there's something higher, is that a knowledge? Can you know it? Can you know it as solidly as you know something in the physical world? With an equivalent knowledge or the same kind of knowledge? Or is it intrinsically unknowable? Stay with me carefully. It's a very important process of thought here. Let's say like this. If it's knowable, let me argue that it's knowable. You can go through a certain process of Torah study and investigation, and you can look at the world in a certain way, and you can end up conclusively knowing that Hashem exists and what that means. Let's assume that for a moment. Maybe we haven't shared together the secret of what that pathway is. But let's assume there is such a possibility. Then the question is, what is faith? You don't have to believe in something that you know. Then the name of the game is knowledge. Let's seek the knowledge, right? If you're learning a profession, right? So until you know it, let's get this clear. I don't know what your profession is, you as an individual. But if you take medicine as an example. So as a medical student, they want to teach him something that he doesn't yet know. I've been through the experience, I can tell you. So they put these things in your ears, and they put it on the chest of the patient. They say, here, listen to the heart beating. And your heart sinks, because you can't hear any heart beating. The first time you put that thing on a patient's chest, you hear the buses going side in the street, you hear the rumble of things, you hear your fingers creaking, you hear everything, but you don't hear any heart beating. And then they say to you, look, can you hear this valve and that valve, and you can hear, I think you're a total failure. Right? You have to take it on faith that this thing can be done. You don't negate it, you don't call it faith, it's a knowledge. You go through the process. A few years later, when you practiced and experienced here, you find that you're listening to this thing, you're not hearing anything else at all, and you can actually see what's happening inside. You can actually see it. You can see the shape of those valves, and you can see you can see it. And it's as real as if you could open it and look at it. Whatever your professional field is, that's the way it is. If you showed me something in your field of expertise that you do, I would have to take it on faith. Until I gain the practice in that area. But that doesn't mean we call it faith. We loosely say you take it on faith, on trust. But it's a knowledge, you understand? If you go through the apprenticeship, and you go through the process, and you train your hands, and you train your... You'll eventually know it. Is this clear? Something that can be known, even if you don't know it yet, you don't call faith. You call it the search and the process of gaining the knowledge. And when you get there, you have the knowledge. If our faith, if knowledge of something higher, which is the definition of the meaning of life itself. If that is knowable, there's no place for faith. Let's talk about knowledge. It's hard to get. Good, it's hard to get. Take you many years. It'll take you many years. You have to live on a mountaintop and meditate and eat rhubarb and find some teacher who's going to teach you to float. And you'll do it. If you're serious about it, you'll do it. So you talk about knowledge. How long and how hard. However hard it is, however long it takes. There's no place. Are you with me? There's no place to talk about faith, which means blind sort of belief. On the other hand, if it's not knowable, you're in bigger trouble. Because if it's not ultimately knowable, if there is no process of investigation that can take you there, then what's it worth? Because if I have to leap off and say I accept it, when you can't demonstrate it to me, then you might as well believe in anything. On the contrary, if faith means a blind thing, if faith means a blind leap, right? Like in the non-Jewish world, they talk about blind faith. A leap of faith, right? Belief, the word belief in English means something that you can't know. You don't believe something you know it. You only believe something that you can't... Yeah? So if this thing is blind, and if you never can really know it, then what's it worth? On the contrary, somebody whose belief is less logical would be even greater. This is an issue we have with Christians. I don't know if you've ever been engaged in a discussion with a Christian missionary. It's not a recommended activity. But if you get into one of those discussions, and they throw their proofs at you, and you know your stuff, and you show them that what they're saying is not logical. Not logical, right? We say in Judaism that the process is a logical process. So they say to you things that you refute logically. Right? I mean, I've had this experience, very interesting experience. I'm talking about sincere people. They'll say to you, for example, that the person they regard as messianic and whatever they regard him as, they say that one of the proofs that he was who they claim him to be is that he's descended from the house of David. Yeah, we're not discussing Christian theology this evening. I just want to give an example. He's descended from the house of David, and they have various versions of the genealogy from the house of David. So that he's descended from the house of David is one of the qualifications for being the Mashiach. If you then point out to them that according to them, his father wasn't his father. According to them, his father had nothing to do with it. It was only his mother. You know the story. Therefore, how can you call on the genealogy of his father? Do you see the problem? Either his father was his father and he came from David maybe. Or his father had nothing to do with it. And then don't tell me that he's from the house of David. It goes to the father, not the mother. So they say, if you raise that problem, they say to you, see how great our faith is? It doesn't make sense and we believe anyway. But they don't mean that in a trivial sense. They don't mean that. It's a mistake to think. They're not talking about foolish people. They mean that faith transcends logical demonstrations. Do you understand? That faith transcends, it's got... You should know that in Muslim theology, I don't know if you know about this, in Islamic philosophy, there's another version of this issue. In Islamic philosophy, they believe there's a very deep underlying energy in Muslim thinking that the world has no organized path. Our early sources talk about it, Maharal and others. They say that the Islamic faith is taken root in the hearts of people who are desert people, nomadic people. The idea of the desert is that there's no organized pathway. There's people who live wherever the journey takes them. Some sources say that's why the Arabs in early days used to worship the dust of their feet. You know, when the Arabs came to visit Abraham, he washed their feet. The reason he washed their feet was because they worshipped the dust of their feet. So he didn't want them to bring that fetish, that object of idolatrous worship into his home. What on earth does it mean to worship the dust of your feet? Our sources explain the dust of the feet is the symbol and residue of the journey itself. They worship the journey itself. That means wherever the journey takes you is a holy destination. That means there's a thought process here that whatever I'm doing is what he wants me to do. Whatever I'm doing, it can be wiping out people, killing innocent, no matter what it is. Or what, genuine hospitality, whatever their values are, genuine faith. They have an intense level of faith. Some Torah sages have said, halavai, that we should have the intensity of faith that they have as a people. But what is the faith? That I chart my course and it's done totally with him. They're not being superficial. They mean it very deeply. What is that course? Where I'm going. How do you get to such a thing? There's a deep current of energy in Islamic thinking that you can't understand him anyway. There's a deep truth here. You have to understand where these things come from. You can't understand him. Can you ultimately answer why he created the world and why he needs you? Ultimately, no, the answer is you can't. So then what are you trying to explain to me, you Jews, that it's logical until thus far? If at that point you're going to have to make a leap of faith anyway, so admit that the whole thing is not logical. There's a deep truth here. But we say no. We say that our process is a deep process of logic, and yet there's a leap. That has to be very, very solidly understood. Do you see what we're up against here? So let's phrase the question. These are not trivial and silly things. Let's try and phrase the question. Is knowledge, is God consciousness possible? That means, can you know it? Don't talk to me about faith. If you cannot know it, then it's all a leap of faith, but then it's not for me. Because you might as well leap into anything. How can you have a discussion even about the subject? If it's not knowable and it's not logical, I'll start giving you arguments. You'll turn around and say, look, it's not logical anyway. So like, I just believe what I believe. End of discussion. You want to believe? Go ahead. Is the point clear? Yeah? So we have to answer a fundamental question. Does Judaism claim that knowledge of these things is attainable? Yeah, or not? And then we have a second question. If it's attainable, forget faith, talk about knowledge. If it's not attainable, then like, who cares? Is the question clear? You're not going to enjoy the answer unless you hear the question. Right? Let's try and work through this. The answer is very rich and very demanding, very paradoxical. We say both are true. We say like this. At a superficial level, we say it's knowable. It's knowable. And we'll have to deal with the question of why do we call it faith? And the answer to that question will be that there's a certain point that's not knowable. There's a certain movement of the heart. There's a certain inward movement that always remains. Right? That gap is always there. But it's our job to tie down exactly where that gap is. Perhaps we can just begin like this. We'll have to come back to it in more detail. But the basis of the discussion is you have to understand that this is so fundamental. There is nothing in life that is ultimately knowable. I'm sorry to have to tell you this. There is nothing that is ultimately knowable. Let me give you an example. The deep work of faith, the knowledge of Hashem's existence, is an expanded sense of the knowledge of self. Knowledge of your own existence, and solidly grasping what that is, and when you're more mature, grasping the limitations of that self, is the beginning of an awareness that there's something beyond that self. Right? The most important tool in the knowledge of something higher is knowing that you exist. And knowing that you exist is not logical. It cannot be proven. There's no formal derivation of your own existence. In fact, it's even more frightening to think that all the most important things in life cannot be proved at all. The most important things, that you exist, cannot be formally demonstrated. I think, therefore I am, means I know that I am. In my mind, therefore I am. It does not mean that it's a formal logical demonstration. Knowing that you have free will, that you're not just acting out the results of your own chemical genetic process, you just have to know that. You cannot demonstrate that. Knowing that you're human and not an animal, which amounts to the same thing, an evolutionist will tell you that you're a sophisticated gorilla, or amoeba, or chimpanzee, and you say there's a categorical difference between me and an animal. It is not demonstrable. The knowledge that you're Jewish, that you're Jewish. You think you know you're Jewish only because they told you? Yeah, you think that's... Even knowing that your parents are your parents. I had to tell you this, but the most basic things in your awareness live in a knowledge that is not provable. Let me give you a dramatic example. How do you know that you're awake, right? I mean, those of you who are, yeah. How do you know that you're awake? How do you know that you're awake and not dreaming? Now, don't rush to answer this. When you're dreaming, you think you're awake. You certainly do, otherwise you wouldn't be so terrified. When you go through the most horrifically terrifying dream, you're terrified because if you knew you were dreaming, you'd enjoy it. It's another movie. The reason that you're so horrifically terrified when you're dreaming is because you think you're awake, don't you? I'm not talking about a dream where you know, yeah, when you dream, you're dreaming. That you really need therapy if you go through that. I'm talking about the kind of dream that fills you with ecstasy or terror. The reason you experience those emotions is because you think you're awake. So if you think you're awake when you're dreaming, how do you know that you aren't just dreaming now and thinking that you're awake? Again, please, it's a very important question. The reason you know you're awake now is simply because you know it. You know it firsthand. You know it in primary terms. There's no what are you going to do? Pinch yourself. But in your dream, you could be pinching yourself and feeling it. Speaking to me. You could be speaking to me in your dream too. Bertrand Russell, many of the great philosophers have found other versions. One classic version of this problem is, how do you know that the world wasn't created 5 minutes ago with all your memories of the past already there and intact? Maybe 1 minute ago. With all the past coded in. Where's the past? In your memory, right? The entire past up to 1 second ago is not here. It's only in your consciousness. Maybe you were created 1 minute ago with a consciousness extending. It's a ridiculous concept. But you cannot disprove it. It's also irrelevant. It makes no difference. It makes no difference. I mean, you could claim legally that you don't owe me the money you borrowed last year. Do you hear? There's nothing that you can know. No amount of miracle. No amount. Rav Tzadok HaKohen says that if Aristotle would have been at Sinai, listen to this amazing statement. If Aristotle would have been at Sinai, he would have been able to bring Moshe Rabbeinu Moses 1,000 proofs that had never happened. After they'd been there, he would have been able to prove it. Because it's an impossible thing. It's a logical contradiction in terms that the infinite meets the finite and you're there to witness it without disappearing. And not only that, he would have been right, logically. And he would have been wrong, in fact. So before you begin the discussion, you have to know, is there a leap of faith in accepting God's existence? There's a leap of faith in accepting your existence. In accepting that you're human, accepting that you are awake. If you're searching for a knowledge of Hashem's existence, more certain than that, you can leave now. Leave now, there's an end. We don't look for that. In Jewish thinking, we look for good enough evidence that I can act on the consequences. There's good enough evidence to me that begins with what I call common sense, that I'm here, and things are real, certain things are dangerous, other things are not. I'm not dreaming when I'm not dreaming, I'm awake. That's good enough, and I posit my life on those principles. Is it ultimately provable, black and white? No, it's not. It's good enough. Again, I hate to tell you this, but we live our lives Jewishly, religiously, with commitment, even to death itself. Because it's logical enough. Not because it's ultimately proved. And by the way, anybody who claims that they're not going to move spiritually unless you prove it to me, I want that individual to show me that that's how they live the rest of their life. When I, as a doctor, prescribe a medication, do I know for sure that it's going to work? Do I even have first-hand knowledge of all the research? No, there's a certain degree of information that has been relied on through common sense and other... And you do that too as a patient. Or when you trust an engineering thing... There's no absolute knowledge. There's a collection of human experience that's put together that gets to a level of statistical acceptability that makes it good enough. And you live your life that way. When you take a plane ride, when you drive in a car, which is much more risky, as it happens. Do you do it because you know? No, but there's enough. So if you posit your life on those things, if that's your standard, then we can richly demonstrate that fulfilling mitzvahs, right, and being an observant Jew, and relating at least to the study of things that are beyond, is at least that solid. But if you think that it's provable and can be and should be proved, you're making a tragic error. And if it were, you'd have no free will. Okay, is the point clear? There's a different standard of knowledge here. That doesn't make it any less meaningful, right, or worth predicating your life on than all the rest of the things that occupy your consciousness, which are no more solid and maybe less so. Now, with that background, let's try and approach our question. We say this. We say that the knowledge of these things is attainable. And we'll have to deal with the meaning of the word faith. And right? This is completely contrary to the secular notion or certain other religions' notions that faith is a completely blind act. You bamboozle yourself, you hypnotize yourself, you somehow motivate yourself to believe something because lots of other people do, because somebody told you. That's not the Jewish approach. We don't approach it that way. We say that it's a process of discovery. Torah learning is a process of learning how to think critically. You know, it's a remarkable thing. When a person comes to study Torah, which is the lifeline, right? If you want to know what you should do first, you start studying. What should you first? Shabbos, kosher food? The answer is it's all critical. But the lifeblood, the umbilical cord, is to learning Torah. If you don't study the subject, you don't train yourself. We're not talking about study by getting facts. We're talking about opening your mind. And you know what the methodologies of Torah study? Learning to question critically. Yeah, you come for a Talmudic class. If the teacher's good, he doesn't tell you what's going on. He makes you work it out. He doesn't want you to know the facts. He wants you to learn how to... Yeah. You know, it's a much more valued skill in Talmudic learning to ask a good question than say a good answer. But my rabbi once said, we are not contracted to give answers. We may well be contracted to ask good questions. To ask a good question and give a bad answer, better have no answer. The first thing you do in Torah study is learn how to question critically. The way the Talmud works, like no other wisdom that there is, the way the Talmud works is peculiar. The way Talmudic logic works is that a postulate is raised, and the Talmud brings very, very sophisticated proofs. And after proving it to you, shows you where it's wrong. And with having broken down that preconception, you have a more sophisticated concept, you develop that to its maximum and show where that's wrong. This is called Hava Amina and Maskana. You have what's called a Hava Amina, what I would have thought. And you discover the truth by showing where that which meets the eye at first glance is wrong. Do you know what this is? It's a training for penetrating reality. It's a training for moving out into the world and not accepting first glance. You look at a person, they make an impression on you. Not so fast. Not so fast. Yeah. Penetrate deeper. You look at a situation. The world is not what it appears to be at first glance. Torah training is not to accept what you see at first glance. Question it critically. Strip away the layers. Penetrate beneath the surface. And when you've done that, go to the next layer. See where that's inadequate and go deeper. What sort of a system wants people to ask critical questions? only a system that's dealing with the truth. If you're dealing with something that's not true, you don't want people to ask questions. You want them just to chant mindlessly. Right? You want them to say, I believe, I believe, I believe. The last thing you want is people asking questions. But if you're confident that you're dealing with the truth, you want people to ask questions, not afraid. Yeah? There's no, in Torah, there are no illegitimate questions. On the contrary, the more threatening they are, the more close they are to the core of reality, the better the question is. Provided you're asking to know, not to attack. A person is asking on the, you have to ask in Torah, not on Torah. If you attack it, that means you have a presupposition that it's wrong, you're not going to grow spiritually. You have to ask with an open mind. I don't know. Show me. There's no holds barred on those questions. Why should there be? So, process of discovery. Now, we have to answer two questions now. Stay with me slowly. There are layers here to the thinking. The first question is, if there's a claim being made that certain things are knowable, which at present I do not know, just like in a profession or any other area of skill and expertise and education, then point me the direction. Show me, what do I do to get the knowledge? Take many years, I'm prepared to do that. Nothing more important than this. Takes many years. Once when I was a junior medical student, I went to a certain rabbi, and I said to him, I'd like to be a Torah healer. I'd like to know how to do healing from a Torah perspective, not just from a technical perspective. He said to me, there's no question, finish medical school, and then you go to yeshiva for 7 years. I said, 7 years? He said, look, if it takes 7 years to be a doctor, what makes you think it's simpler to learn science? Maybe demanding. But if there's a process of discovery, then show me what it is. And the answer is, there is a process of discovery. And it's as follows. We don't have time to go into it fully, by no means, but just to point the direction very briefly, each of these elements needs full discussion, and then it will lead us to considering what's the meaning of faith if the knowledge lies in this direction. The knowledge is to be gained in the following way. Again, stay with me carefully. If somebody asks you formally, what are the Jewish demonstrations of God's existence? Right? It's plain and simple. Don't give me any fluff and any... I want to know. So the answer is, there are two processes of thought. Okay, there are two currents of energy that our sources deal with. The one is more primary and more reliable. The second is valid but not as reliable. The first is investigation of Torah itself. And the second is scientific and logical examination of the world. One being a mirror of the other. Torah means accessing, investigating objectively the Torah claim that it was given from at Sinai from heaven to human beings who experienced that firsthand, millions of people. Who experienced that firsthand, and not only experienced it firsthand, beyond any shadow of doubt, meaning, make no mistake, when we say beyond any shadow of doubt, even those people had the same shadow of doubt that you have about your existence. They had free will, not at the moment of the revelation itself, right? Because they were lifted out of their bodies, they weren't human at that moment, right? But when they came back in and the next day they woke up, they still had the same level of knowledge that you do, is it? In fact, on the contrary, it's a tragic error to think, as another subject again, it's a tragic error to think that Sinai was necessary for that level of proof. Sinai wasn't necessary. Again, Jews often make the mistake. The ultimate proof of God's existence is we met him at Sinai. The truth is that meeting him personally, face to face, so to speak, at Sinai was not necessary. Why? Because the miracles that were demonstrated in Egypt, which were far less than the Sinai experience, far less. You could be much more skeptical about those things. That hail fell, that had fire inside, and that water turned to blood. Those are incredible demonstrations. You'd be very impressed if you saw that. You'd be religious for at least a couple of days after that. But they're not the same as having the prophetic experience of having your soul, your neshama, leave your body and cleave to the oneness. That not. Those were good enough proofs of Hashem's existence. How do we know? Because the Egyptians were held to task. The Egyptians were held accountable. The Egyptians never stood at Sinai. They would demonstrate, Torah says openly, I will show my wonders in Egypt, that they should know, the Egyptians, the non-Jews, should know that I exist. So if an Egyptian is expected to know of Hashem's existence because he sees water turning to blood, that's obviously good enough. You don't need Sinai for that. So why did we stand at Sinai? We didn't stand at Sinai to have proven that God exists. Because between you and me, it's no more proof. Because that little gap of skepticism that if you want, you can always resort to, you can have there as well. What they saw in Egypt was good enough. In fact, it wasn't even necessary. The tradition from their forefathers was good enough. But it's certainly good enough, even for Egyptians who were completely sunk in the lower world. Why do we stand at Sinai? It's another subject. We didn't stand at Sinai to have a proof, right? Zelo inyan, as it's put there so beautifully, zelo inyan shel otzmat ha'ochacha. It's not a case of the intensity of the proof. Zinyan shel echut ha'yediyah. What a remarkable thing. It's a question of the quality of the knowledge. We stood at Sinai not to have a more clear-cut proof of existence. We stood at Sinai to have a deeper appreciation of personal relationship with him that the non-Jews don't have. Completely different subject. But nevertheless, the miracles in Egypt, standing at Sinai, it goes back to then. The problem for you and me is, we didn't stand there. Personally, you and me. Kabbalistically, our souls were there, our neshamas were there, every Jew can relate to that. But in terms of clear, open, logical, common sense, conscious, I was not there. So how do I verify it? I have to go back through the story. I have to go through the story. What my great-great-grandparents heard from their great-great... You have to go through the story. And it's not simple. Not simple. It needs to be thoroughly investigated. And there are classic works of Torah thinking that do that. The Kuzari, for example, has a fantastic analysis of this. If you want to read a modern, easily accessible English version of that, Rabbi Gottlieb has a book on that. It's called, I think it's called Living Up to the Truth, where he analyzes what he calls the Kuzari principle, which is the derivation, that means the logical, aggressively inquisitive approach to how accurate is the Sinai, how accurate is the tradition from Sinai. That means if you wish to falsify it, how easy is it to do that? And it's a remarkably, it opens your eyes, that investigation. I mean, you have to understand here, we're talking not, again, we can't get into the thing in detail, but you're talking here not about a person who had a revelation. You're talking about millions of people. Do you know, it's a remarkable thing that the Torah has safeguarded this in purity for us. Do you know that no other religion on earth, no other human being on earth, has ever claimed a revelation in the presence of more than one person? Do you know that? A direct divine revelation. If you go back to the source of all world religions, all, even recent ones, let alone the great world religions, they all go back to the testimony of one individual who said that God spoke to him. That's a critical thing to know. When Muhammad came out of his tent, not that long ago, and he said God spoke to him and dictated the Quran. So the Jewish people said, and who witnessed it with you? When we stood at Sinai, there were 3 million of us. We all had the same experience. He said, no, this I received alone. The Jews said, look, it's not good enough for us. When the founder of Christianity, right, not him himself, he never claimed this, but Paul, who lived some hundreds of years later, when Paul claimed that he had a vision on the Damascus Road, and that God told him thus and thus about the prophet, the Jews said, and who had this vision with you? Who was there to see it? He said, no, you can trust me. The Jews said, it's not good enough for us. That doesn't measure up to our standards. And you can follow religion throughout. That's a remarkable thing. You can take whatever religion you want. There's a church in America, in Utah. Very, very active missionary people. They trace themselves back to a person who lived 200 odd years ago, who had a vision of 7 planets and a whole book was dictated to him. Who had this dream with you? This is dream. And it's a massive movement today. Again, we're not here to insult or impugn other people's beliefs. It's not the issue. Because he had a dream on his own doesn't prove it's wrong. But you wanted me to change. We are the only people on earth who claim that the revelation itself, the original point of origin, was witnessed by more than one, let alone millions. It's a remarkable thing. And then you have to follow through the generations. How reliable is the transmission? People think it's lost in the mists of time. You know, people told other people, maybe it's a folklore that got blown out of proportion. You have to examine that critically. And again, we can't do it in detail now. Just give you an example. Do you know how many generations there were between Sinai and us? So people think, you know, endless, countless generations. If you count a generation as 40 years, which is a very reasonable time for transmission from, in fact, in 40 years, you can even transmit to your grandchildren, right, with your Torah mitzvah, to teach your grandchildren Torah. If you divide a generation to 40 years, between Sinai and us, you have about 80 generations. It's about 3,300 years, approximately, let's say. 80 odd generations. 80 generations? That's not so much. That's not the vast mists of time. And not only that, we know who they were. We know the names of the leaders, and we have the original writings of specific individuals throughout those generations. Who was at a prophetic level? The Rambam lists it. The Rambam, in his introduction to the Mishnah, lists the names, and we have the original works of those people, corroborated by all Jews on earth and never disputed. A remarkable thing. This is not some vague folklore. You can follow it back. And there's never been, that means, do you know what that means? That Jews all over the world from Sinai on sat at the Seder table every Pesach night and told the same story all over the world. There could be Jews in Yemen sitting around the Seder table and he'd be telling his wife and his other wife and his other wife. the story with all her children and her children and her children, and they all got the same story. It was Jews in Lithuania, and no matter where it was throughout the eons of history, throughout those 3,200 years, telling the same story. And we have no record of anybody saying it was falsified until this generation, right? Where people just don't know. They didn't hear from their parents anymore. On the contrary, it's very challenging to try to falsify the tradition, to try to think where somebody made it up, and remarkable thing. So without going into detail, one course of investigation is to examine the claim that Torah makes and the transmission, the veracity of the transmission down to us that needs to be critically examined without accepting any fobs and any loose thinking, right? It needs to be rigorously done, and our classic sources do that. The second method of investigation, and that's a rich subject in its own right, the second one is looking at the world scientifically. Scientifically. Yeah. Does the world speak of random, chaotic, accidental processes? Or does the world speak of highly precise, complex organization? But you have to be objective. I mean, I can't help telling you this. I mean, I don't want to. There's a certain professor at Oxford University. He's written a number of books on evolution, proving that God could not exist. Proving, yeah, that evolution is true. And the statement he makes there is that anybody who thinks that evolution is not true is like denying that the earth goes around the sun. It's on the same level of factual, established fact. Why? So he says like this. Because complexity, complex things like human beings, even animal cells, even one protein, are so stupendously complex that they could never have come about by accident. That's what he says. That's clear. So we have to explain how they came about. How do they come about? Because very simple things accidentally underwent very small changes. I'm not going to go through evolution here. And eventually ended up as complex things, and he gives a very detailed account of how that all have happened. Right? And therefore, but listen carefully, the claim is, you cannot have anything complex. Listen carefully, it's amazing. You cannot have anything complex that happened by accident. Yeah, the old example that's always given in the English literature is if you stumbled across a watch in the desert, you would never assume that the winds and the hurricanes and the forces of time and nature had put together this watch. You would assume somebody dropped it there, a human being. You come across one protein molecule which is zillions of times more complicated than a wristwatch. Stupendous, mind-boggling. You know, it's in a protein. So that couldn't have happened by accident. No, absolutely agreed. No, so what happened? Simple things organized themselves by the process. It was like, what was the point of origin of the simple things? That you don't have to explain. Simple things. So listen carefully. What's a complex thing, he says? Biological organism, a human cell, DNA, mechanism, protein, etc. Right? But excuse me, how did inorganic matter develop? There's no evolution there. What about the moon? You know, one atom. Do you know what an atom is? Do you know what one molecule, if you take, do you know one molecule, the stupendous, nobody understands yet the forces that keep the electrons where they are and the nuclear forces. Stupendous physics has gone mind-boggling. What goes into that? What explains that? He said, no, that's a simple thing. That's what he said. That's simple. That doesn't need explanation. We start there, right? That's a given. Now I'll explain to you how complex things like human beings arise. What's the man saying? You have to be a professor at Oxford to be able to say things like that. I mean, that's... To say that the moon is a simple thing that doesn't need explanation? That one molecule, one atom, doesn't require explanation? That could have happened by accident? You have to have your head read to speak that way. So, the world speaks of organization. This is what they say, not what we say. They say that the world does not speak of random chaos. And something that complex and that incredibly complex speaks of an organizing principle. Right? And that takes you into the process of analyzing what that organizing principle or force or being is. But there's a fascinating feature. Please stay with me carefully. This is not often appreciated. There's a fascinating feature of that process of investigation that leads you to something that transcends the world. And the feature is as follows. Listen well. All proofs of God's existence, all proofs of Hashem's existence, all proofs of yeah, something higher, by this method, are all only proofs by exclusion. They go like this. I'll give you the general form of the argument. Again, it needs to be more built up in a more sophisticated way. The general form of the argument is like this. Not that we follow a process by which we derive God's existence, but we try to prove that the world could be explained in its own terms, and we find that difficult to do. That's a process of... It goes like this. Take the world, or one molecule, or one atom, or one cell, and ask if this could have happened by accident. Does this look random? An atom, never mind biology, where evolution gets involved. Talk about an atom, or a molecule, or the nature of the periodic table of chemicals that organize themselves into the compounds we're familiar with. So, stupendous in its complexity. And in its remarkable simplicity. You know, the whole world of chemical of material is made up of a handful of elements. You know that? In the whole periodic table today, all substances, elements known, there are only 150 or so. And most of what you're familiar with in the world is made up of 5 or 6. Oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, a few metals. And those things are so crafty in their construction that when you put them together, they make more and more interesting and complex things. If sodium, for example, sodium is an explosive metal. If you expose sodium to the air, it explodes. Chlorine is a deadly poisonous green gas. When you put them together, you get salt. That is very crafty. That is... And these two things, when they harmonize that way, they form salt, which you need to survive. And never once in your entire existence do they dissociate and the sodium explode and the chlorine poison you. It never happens that way. They are so cunningly devised. You understand what's going on? Do you know what's in salt? They are so cunningly devised that they have the incredible properties, and yet they're also able to blend in ways that the more you start putting them together, the more... They just understand what that means. Be lost in admiration for the rest of your life. And the more that they study, the more amazing depth and themes of consistency running through them they find. Also spiritual messages. In modern physics today, it's purely spiritual. Always new secrets. And more beauty and more harmony. So we say like this. Could that have happened by itself? That just boggles the mind. So therefore what? That implies that something else must have done it. But that's an argument by... Are you with me? An argument by... There are only two types of proof in logic or mathematics. One is proof by derivation. One is proof by exclusion. There's only two possibilities. Either I derive something from first principles until I have it demonstrated. Or I have A or B must be true. I cannot derive or prove A, but I can show that B is false. If I show that B is false, A must be true. It's as certainly true as if I derived it. But there's a very big difference. When you prove something by derivation from the ground up, you end up knowing what it means. When you're not proving that something must be true because the alternatives don't make sense, you know just as surely that it must be true, but you have no idea what it is. All you know is that all the other options, the world is a random accident, it's all chaos, things bumped into each other and they organize. That just doesn't make sense to me. So what did it? Something else. But what that thing is, that course of investigation will not show you. Scientific examination of the world, the so-called argument from design, and all similar argumentations, all they can ever do is bring you to the brink. They can bring you to the edge of the cliff. Uncomfortably squeeze you to the edge of the cliff. That the alternatives, the more you check them out, the less tenable they become. But to leap off the cliff into that zone of Torah and knowledge of those worlds, that's a completely different exercise. That needs Torah. So if you go to a seminar, you have people who are seeking faith, and they go to one of these religious seminars, and there they give you this whole weekend thing where they give you all these proofs and all these amazing... Be careful. Those are only the proofs by exclusion. The aim of such a seminar, if you walk out of there totally believing, your eyes going like this, zing, 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 right? I believe. You need counseling, you need therapy, you need to go and have a milkshake. You're in trouble, right? Because... You've misunderstood. That's not what it's designed. What it's designed to do is shake your firm belief in the opposite, shake that up, and move you to the edge of a cliff where alternative explanations are problematic. Not disproved, but seriously weakened. But what is reality, they've got nothing to say about. That you need an experience of Torah. For that you need an inner experience, a meditational experience. That is where the leap of faith is. Do you understand? The leap of faith... please... Please stay with me carefully. Such a beautiful thing to understand. What are we saying? We said, is it knowable or not? Jewish answer, it's knowable. Within certain limits, it's knowable. So what's faith? The answer is like this. What's knowable is only that a certain thing must be. But getting into that thing and where that takes you is totally unknowable. Let me try and illustrate this. We're coming very soon in the next week or two to Bereshis, right? Genesis, beginning of the Torah. The first, you have there an ordeal. Ordeal of faith. Let me give an example. These are such, when the beginning of the Torah, the fundamentals are laid down, these are by far the most critical things to understand. First Jew, first beginner, forerunner of the Jewish people, Avraham Avinu, Abraham. Hashem says to him, listen carefully, because here you're learning what faith means. We're not talking about the final test, we had to kill his son. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the first one. Hashem said to him, I want you to go on a journey. I want you to move. Now understand, you have a parallel current of energy. One energy is move, get up from this place and go to that place. Get up from the land of where you live, Ur Kasdim, Mesopotamia, and go to Canaan, what we call Israel. Incidentally, our claim on Israel. Now, why should we get political? Well, we'll get there eventually. But if you want to know, our claim on Israel lies in this zone. It does not lie in political argumentation. Do you think you were there first, and that's why it's yours? It's not ours for that reason. Not because we were first. We weren't there first. Not that they were there first. Not that they were there first. But there were others there. And Rashi, the first Rashi in the Torah, says that Israel's ours because he gave it to us. Not because we were there first. We weren't there first. Rashi says he took it away from whom he wanted, and he gave it to whom he wanted. Don't try that argument who was there first. Because a lot of Palestinians will show you that before you came on the scene, their families were living there. Their families got there supplanting somebody else. So then you're talking about might is right. Whoever supplants whoever it is, you want war, that's what you want. And whoever can force their way in, that's what we want. Unless you come onto a higher discussion, which is very relevant with the Arab world, because they believe in those things. That's where the discussion has to be positive. Now, this needs thought. But that first journey to that land, can you see that the final showdown is going to be between us and them? Can you see why it must be them? Because it's an argument and it's a battle of faith. Why do you think the Maharal says that the final showdown will be between us and the Ishmael people? The Maharal said that 400 years ago. And he's quoting Chazal, who said it 2,000 years ago, using sources that are 3,000 years. Why? How did they know then? How does the Medrash know that on the holy site of the Beis HaMikdash will be a... How does it know that? How did it know it would be like that? Because the showdown will be a showdown of faith. That's what it is. That's where the test will be. Because they really believe. Beyond death. But let's go back to the beginning of that journey. Hashem said to him, Lech lecha, go from your land, me'atzecha, yeah, from your home, your land, your forefather's thing, your house, go on a journey. Now, you understand the two journeys here. One is the physical journey from this place to that, and the other is the inner journey of faith. The Torah is always speaking on more than one level. Yeah, the Torah is always speaking to a 6-year-old, which means he told him, go from here to there. And it's always speaking to a 26 and a 36, etc., etc. year old, which means go from here to there inwardly. Yeah, the land of Israel always means the higher land. Eretz HaChaim, that means Eretz HaElyona, it means the higher world. That's what it means. Always means that. So there's a debate among our authorities whether the Torah is talking in the higher world and hinting in the lower world, or talking in the lower world and hinting in the higher world. Actually, both are true. So listen to this dual journey. Go from where you are unto the place that I will show you. El Aretz Asher Ar'eka, the land that I shall show you. So the commentaries ask, all our sources discuss this question, why did God not tell him where to go? He said to him, leave your place and be, listen carefully, it's the most amazing thing. Yeah, if you want to put your finger on your journey and where your life should be leading, right? You can't say it more clearly than this. Leave your birthplace and your father's home, literally, and go to the place which I'll show you geographically. When you get there, I'll show you. Just start walking. What does that mean? You tell a person, I want you to go on a journey. You don't tell him where to leave from. He leaves from where he is. You tell him where he's going. No? If you're standing on King's Cross Station, I tell you, I want you to take the Edinburgh train. That's sensible. If I say, leave King's Cross, you say to me, you're raving, right? Yeah? The destination doesn't tell him. Do you hear? There's something very strange here. So the commentaries say, listen, it's so beautiful. He didn't tell him where because he wanted to make it a journey of faith. To show his love for God, he would follow him even though the destination is unknown. But listen to the meaning here. Amazing thing. The nature of an inner journey, the nature of a journey of faith, is that you cannot know the destination. You're moving to a new self. You can't know that till you become it. Yeah. This journey is a journey to your real, to your true self, to your developed self, to your higher self. And of course, it's stages and stages. When you're told to move, all you can be told is to leave behind who you are now. You have to break who you are now and you move into something new. You can't be told what that new thing is. If you were told what it is, you would grasp it now in the distorted, immature, infantile version of the way you see it now. Yeah? That's where the blindness is. Not that you have to leap off the cliff. You're an idiot to leap off a cliff if you don't know that you have to do it. You're a fool. We don't leap off because we think it's a good idea. You think he decided to kill his son because he thought about a nice thing to do? He went to kill his son because God told him. You know how clear you have to be about that. But knowing that you have to do it, you think that makes it easy. You think you know whether you're capable of doing such a thing. Do you know who you will be when you get there? So when he tells him, move towards yourself, he can't tell him the destination. You know, it's like if you take a person living inside a prism, you know, a glass crystal prism, and you shine white light, you want the person to see the white light. You know, inside the prism, it gets broken up into all the colors. But you desperately want the person to see the white light. So you shine more and more and more. He will never see it until he breaks the prism. Until you shatter who you are. Until you break down the immature version of who you are. Your own limitation. You leave that behind. And you can't leave it behind until you can't safely put one foot on the edge of the cliff. You can't do that. You have to totally shatter who you are with total knowledge that it's the right thing to do. Not because you decided, you bamboozled yourself, somebody told you. That's ridiculous. When you become a bold shiva, yes, and you leave behind a lifestyle and certain social friends and activities and all sorts of things, do you know what your life will be? Do you know what, you know who you will be? When you move ahead and you have the faith to know that there's something better and something bigger that you must move towards, you can only move towards it by leaving where you are. That's an act of heroism. Yeah, you have to leap off the cliff. Not because you think it's a good idea. Because you know you have to leap off the cliff. Not because you're bamboozled. That has to be totally secure. Can you see the other side? No, sorry. Not till you get there. Just understand this harmony. Yeah. You're standing on this cliff edge. Yeah, let me make it graphic in case you're not with me. You walk out of here this evening. You're walking down the street. You pass through a dark sort of stretch over there and a big hand taps you on the shoulder. Big hand. An infinitely big hand. If this happens to you, by the way, see me privately, okay? Because you... you turn around and you're facing the creator of the world. You're not hallucinating. You haven't been imbibing anything. And there you stand face to face with unquestionably a prophetic experience. We don't have prophecy now. But assume that happens. He says to you, look, I'd like you to do me a favor. Whatever you say. Right? You're talking here. You're talking, this is a definition of reality. This is reality itself. Your existence is nothing compared to this. He says, look, I'd like you to go tomorrow morning, you take a certain bus and you go down to Wales, over a certain mountain. I want you to climb up and there's 5,000 foot drop over some jagged rocks. I want you to stand on the edge and I want you to leap off. But don't worry, I'll be there to catch you. Now, you're not hallucinating. You know with total clarity that this is reality. It's more than your heartbeat. It's more than the blood coursing through your veins. It's more than anything you know. You know this. The knowledge of your own existence is nothing compared to how intense this knowledge is. So the next morning, you take the trip, don't you? Of course you do. And you walk over to the edge of the cliff. Exactly as it said, all exactly as described, and you go, no? That's Emunah. The fact that you have to leap off that thing, right? If you did that with any doubt in your mind, you'd be an idiot and irresponsible and negligent. You do a thing like that only because it's as clear as anything life can be. But it's only when you leap that you discover where the other side is. Because the leap means leaving behind who you are. That's the voyage of Emuna. What you move to, through the destruction of your immature, limited, pathetically childish self, when you can afford to leave that behind, and it has to be a fearless process, it's a terrifying process. All the security, you're leaping off a cliff, is nothing compared to this, done properly. First you gather the knowledge, you garner the security, to the extent that your cliff edge is known and secure, to that extent and only to that extent you move off. But it takes the courage of breaking down who you are, your concepts, your environment, your habits, your... And if you try and share this verbally with somebody in that world, you'll be made a laughing stock. Have you heard people say, give you an example. Here's a classic example. You're religious people. You've got no ordeals in life. It's all mapped out for you. You've got these blinkers on. You do what the good book says. You follow the instructions. Yeah, it's easy. Me, I'm a secularist. I'm a hero. I go where the truth leads. Yeah, wherever the truth leads, I never know what it's going to be. Tomorrow, if I find out something's true, that's where I go. I'm a hero. Listen carefully. The man of faith, the woman of faith, is a person who moves not because of the blinkers and the rules and the book, but because that process of information and study and clarity indicates that I have to leave where I am now and go. Where will I define myself? I have no idea. What will I be? What will be my sense of identity and meaning? I have no idea. But I invest in that. It will be what it has to be. That's a truly heroic process. The secularist, what does it mean to be secular? That means spirituality and transcendence, that's defined out of the picture. I go where my own tangible, what I can touch and feel, what I can experience empirically, what I can put in the lab and examine, that I trust. So look what he's done. He's defined the borders of reality. He's predefined the borders into a safe zone. And he says, in there I go anywhere. Who's the hero and who's the coward? Yeah? That means I'll go anywhere, but not religion. I'll go anywhere, but not that which can't be known. He's already predefined the fact that it can't be known. This is what Emuna means. The journey begins with certainty, with clarity. We seek the knowledge. We don't get bamboozled or hypnotized. We are very demanding in our sense of investigation of the truth and corroborating it and asking critical questions. Judaism doesn't begin without that. That's what Torah study means. We develop at one and the same time the mystical meditational faculty, which transcends words, and the logical, rigorously examined empirical process. There's no question about it. And the one rides on the other. The one without the other is ridiculous. You can just float off into anything. But the logical empirical process, if you don't have that the willingness to use that as the springboard and move into something else where you can genuinely have a new experience and know something in a way that you couldn't have known it before. How can you, when you invest in a relationship, can you possibly know what it will mean? When you invest in a relationship, which means you give yourself away with complete vulnerability. Do you know what marriage is supposed to be? If you're relating to somebody as a friend or a marriage partner whom you know beforehand what it will be like, run a mile. Because if that person, when you sat down with that person for the first 20 minutes, and in 20 minutes they told you all about themselves, 20 minutes? All about themselves? That person is 20 minutes of talk. A marriage partner or a real friend is somebody that when you begin to get to know them, you begin to realize how much more there is that you never knew before. That's somebody worth knowing. And as you richen that experience, and as you get more committed, and as you get more deeply involved with each other, only then you begin to realize levels of depth that you couldn't have dreamed of before. Your breath is taken away by what you see. And that opens up new levels of discovery. That's a relationship. Can't you know what that's going to mean? All you need to know when you move into that is that the person has the depth. And that if fed by the fuel of intensity of a correct relationship, that will flourish and it will develop because of you and what you give. But you have to leap. You have to leap off a cliff. You have to invest. You have to give up your childish immaturity of demanding an I need and I want. Take whatever your example, whatever works for you, whatever example it is. But we don't do that. We stand securely with our feet where it has to be. We're not prepared to move off any edge. We pontificate about, you know, reality and about its borders are. And then you criticize spirituality and what it means. It's getting late, but let's try and summarize. There's only a beginning of the discussion, obviously, because we need to take it into its applications, see what it means in terms of specifics. But that's the process. The Jewish answer to the question of, yeah, what is faith? You break it down. Is something knowable or not? The answer is, within certain constraints of what we mean by knowable knowledge, it's knowable, yes. As rigorously as you can know anything else that you know. At least as rigorously as you know all the important things in life that are not provable empirically, but you posit your life on those things. Even though you can't demonstrate them. Where does that lie inwardly? The practicality is it lies with investigation. If you don't start learning Torah, you start learning how to expand the mind and where that process is. You think you know it all yourself, right? That you can't, all your boundaries, you know exactly where they are. You're not prepared to break open boundaries, which is what Torah learning means. It means moving into a mode of thought that touches infinity without leaving behind the empirical and the logical. On the contrary, based on that. The Rambam says that's why you learn Talmud. The Rambam says the reason you learn Talmud is to be able to think powerfully and logically so that you can engage metaphysics. There's another reason as well. He says you have to know what's right and wrong. First reason you learn is to know what's right and wrong. Otherwise, who knows what you could become. But once you know what's morally right and wrong, the reason is to have a powerful mind. Once you've powerfully engaged in logic and critical thinking, the proper purpose of that is to engage the mystical world. That's what you're here for. You're not here to be a logical thing. You're here to transcend into the higher world. That's what you're here for. You're a spiritual being. That's what the process is. What are the two prongs of this? Torah knowledge itself. The truth is, long before you get to investigating Sinai and its transmission, the experience of learning Torah itself is such a rich experience of this. If you want to use the analogy we began with, it's like marrying somebody because the statistics of that person, you know, the details are given to you on paper, the difference between that and the actual experience of knowing someone. And then, talking about what Torah is and what it will do to your mind is completely meaningless idea. Once you engage it, and of course it's not accident that the Torah is called your betrothed, your beloved. Al tikri moirosha, do not call it your inheritance, ela moirosa, your betrothed, your beloved, the one you're engaged to. Torah can only be known with a marital type of intimacy and bond and commitment. It can only be known that way. You have to swim in it, you have to live in it, you have to bond with it. And then there's scientific knowledge of examining the world critically and taking truth from where you find it and examining the evidence objectively. And those two processes bring you to a new consciousness. What is that? To the edge of a cliff where you become aware that the limitations of logic, you see where they are and you see that there's something else. How do you get into that? You begin with spiritual exercises. The first is knowing who you are. Knowing your own sense of existence and beginning to expand that. Do you know one of the Kabbalistic names of Hashem, of God, is Ani? One of the deepest names we have expressing His existence is the word I, me. Yeah, it's a very dangerous idea. You know, we learn that on Sukkot. Hillel, the humblest of all sages, when he arrived in the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, on the incredible rejoicing, Simchas Beis HaShoeva, unbelievable rejoicing. You should read the description in the Gemara of that rejoicing. The tremendous ecstasy of moving into the shadow of faith. Of course, the sukkah they lived in then was the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, what's called Sukkas David. The Gemara, the Mishnah says that not a courtyard in Jerusalem was not lit by the flares. They had lights made of woven wick from the old clothes of the Kohanim in massive bowls of oil. And these incredible, not a courtyard in the whole Yerushalayim was not lit by this light. And all the sages came to rejoice. The simple people only watched. Only the most learned rejoiced. And danced. When Hillel arrived in that convocation of sages, he said, Imani kan hakol kan. Simply translated, if I am here, everything's here. Seemingly the most egotistical statement you could ever make. But he was the humblest of men. What he meant was, Imani kan. That means the deep sense of I, that is only the tip, Yeah, the reflection, the projection of the real eye of the world. And I only know that by knowing this eye. You only know it within the inner consciousness of who you are and what you're not. Not then everything is here. That's nothing that logic, yeah, no amount of words are going to be able to do that. So you need meditation. You need a meditational process where you become, make contact with your own inner awareness, where you know how you know these things and you see them clearly. Not because of the words. On the contrary, despite the words. The words can only break this down. You have to learn how to think beyond words. As long as you're thinking in words, there's no hope of reaching this level. As long as you think in a conversation, your inner life goes like a dialogue. That's how most of us live most of the time. You know, and how we live inwardly, we say something to ourselves, and we run around and hear how it sounds, and then sometimes we don't even wait to hear what it's been said before we're ready thinking how we're going to argue back. We interrupt. That's all we do. In yourself. That's how the conversation goes. It's a dialogue. You're talking to this. There's no hope for a person like that. Because as long as it's a dialogue of argumentation, right, you can never know anything higher. You have to learn to still that voice. Those two or more individuals talking to each other, they're talking nonsense. Those voices have to be stilled until you know things as they are, not because words. Words are always bringing them down into a packaged reality that is finite and... No matter how articulate, on the contrary, the more words that are needed, the less hope you have of saying the thing. The more words you need to convey something to somebody, the more hopeless. If you need to really explain in great detail, you might as well forget about it. If you really wish to communicate with somebody, it's somebody that you only need a subtle look and something is shared and they have understood. Then you've got a hope. But when you need to start explaining, you might as well forget about it. So as long as you're busy explaining to yourself and you're engaging this inner conversation and you're talking to yourself, you'll never understand yourself. Those voices have to be stilled. First, they have to be engaged until logic is plain and the logical elements are there and you're a powerful and objective thinker and the emotions and the infantile stuff is put out of the way so that real objectivity is gained. And then you have to go beyond it. You have to learn what that meditational mode is, what that thing called dias is, which is knowledge for its own sake. And the first thing you have to know is me. You have to know who I, what, you have to know my own existence. That's called Ani. And then there's an expansion of that to take in something bigger. On the emotional level, just to give you an example, on the emotional level, this is like love. Knowledge of Hashem and love of Hashem go hand in hand. Love of another is always love of self. You can never love someone else. You can never love someone else. Me to you could be that I'm using you to make me feel good. Love of someone else is always and can only be love of self. Love of someone else means that as I love myself, the size of who I am has become expanded to include, do you understand? That the self that we're dealing with here has become expanded to involve you. That we are, you are me. And then you don't need to talk about love. There's an expanded, you need to be big enough to expand your borders so that that person you talk about loving is not someone else that you love. How can you be one if I am me and you are else? But one, there's no distinction between us. When I've become you, we melted into each other. So there's no difference in me talking about me or you. Right? You mean as much to me as I do because we inextricably become one. Then of course I love you at that time. Yes? The expansion, it needs thought. The expansion of consciousness. That's why the word ahava in Hebrew adds up to 13. Same as the word echad, to become one. Becoming one doesn't mean, you know, romantically we become one. We look into each other's eyes and we... That does not becoming one. Becoming one means that we become indistinguishable. That we become genuinely, the heart becomes one. Knowledge of Hashem means that the knowledge of myself expands into the knowledge of that. That's what it is. This is the beginning of the process. This is the process of Emuna. The first mitzvah in the Torah, which is the mitzvah of understanding the oneness. This is where it begins, and in fact, this is where it ends. We'll stop there.